This is FM 2.0 with the Don, Dean, Stormy, and the Grizz. Forever music.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to FM 2.0 Forever Music. There's many names, but that's the one we're going with right now. And we're just excited to be here. We've got Dean Baldwin. Dean, of course, we're going to do this all the time now. And he, you know, hosts shows on Sirius XM, Strike TV, and just going gangbusters there. We got Stormy. Now, Kent, here's an interesting thing. We had on Allie, Colleen, several times, who's Garth's daughter.
Right.
Stormy's the daughter of Mick Mars of Motley Crue. So.
Let's get it together. Let's get them together and see what happens.
We did an interview together, Stormy and Allie. It was just fun listening to their stories growing up, watching their dads perform.
Oh, I bet, you know.
So, yeah, I mean, that's the thing. When you look back, I mean, still to, you know, I know when you've been on before, we talked about the songs you wrote with Garth. And it's going to tie into this album because you wrote a song that Kim, the gentleman's name was Kim that passed away, right? Was that his name?
Kim Williams.
Right. And one of the songs we're going to talk about, because I know the entire song is about him. It was, hold on, don't tell me. I wrote a note because I want to make sure I got this right. Birds on a High Line.
That's correct.
See?
You win.
I win. So we are going to talk about that, but I want to, again, go back a little bit to those songs because Stormy's here. She's not yet talked to you before. Let's just start with, again, If Tomorrow Never Comes.
Oh, that's such a beautiful song.
Right. Now, Stormy.
I like you already, Stormy.
Huh?
I like you already.
Well, yeah. We said it's a beautiful song, and you said Stormy that Garth does it perfect, and that was one of those first ones, if I remember, Kent, that you and Garth wrote together, right? Yeah,
correct. That was the very first song we wrote, and when we wrote it, he was cleaning churches and selling boots, and nobody gave a damn that he was Garth Brooks.
Wow. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't like his name, right? They didn't like the name Garth. They didn't say it was country enough.
Yeah, well, they said, no DJ is going to say Garth on the radio. It sounds like you've got something caught in your throat or whatever, you know? Like, okay.
Well, they say it now.
And we pitched that song around town for a year. We thought it was a good song. And we pitched him around, and that was what we were hearing. He got passed on by everybody more than one time. And one night he got to play one song at the Bluebird because another artist hadn't shown up for an artist showcase. Somebody from Capitol Records was in the audience to hear the other guy and had passed on Garth that week for the third time. And came up to Garth after he did If Tomorrow Never Comes and said, maybe we missed something. Why don't you come back in? And he went back in, got a record deal, and that was his second single and his first number one.
Wow.
Look at that.
I seen him live once. I went to one of his shows.
Yeah.
Swinging over the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it Ain't Going Down Till the Sun Comes Up is another one you wrote with Garth and Kim. And Kim, right? And weren't you sitting outside on a porch or something when you wrote that? Yeah,
we sat out on my back porch on previous house I had because I had moved into this house that had sat vacant for a year and a half and it needed all kind of work. So we went out on the back porch and we wrote Machine Gun lyrics. That's what Garth wanted. And just laughed and had a great time till we were also sunburned. We had to stop and we went in and Garth wanted a demo on it. And we used to just do demos that were guitar vocals on most things, but he wanted a drum machine on this one. And I didn't have much of my recording studio set up, but I got out the drum machine and set it up and got it going. And Garth and Kim were standing behind me and I heard one of them go, "Oh my God." And I turned around and there were termites coming out of the floor and the ceiling and the walls, which isn't good when you got a letter that says you got no termites. So, I was kind of freaking out about it. And Kim said, man, don't worry about it. When Garth and I wrote Papa Love Mama, there were cockroaches all over my apartment, and it was a number one record, and this will be too. And he was right. So strange times, but fun times.
Right. Ain't Going Down was the song that he would swing over the crowd with, right?
Yeah, he kind of had that in mind when we were working on it. He said, if I can get this written right, it'll be my first single off the next album, which you love to hear, and I'm going to swing across the Dallas Stadium singing this song, which I thought he was delusional, till he called me up and told me he was doing it. And so, of course, Kim and I had to fly down there and see him do it. And we were talking to him before he was getting ready to do it. And he said, I just want to let you guys know the rope broke yesterday. Great. But he pulled it off, and it was a phenomenon for sure.
Hey, Kent, you had talked about at the time, you'd said you usually just did vocals and guitar. At that time, you used a drum track. How common is that today when you put a song together for somebody that or any songwriter that they'll literally just submit a very minimalistic recording of it?
How about almost none?
Wow.
These days, it just seems like people can't hear anything unless it's a full-blown demo. And it didn't used to be that way. And also, these guys these days always have a track guy in the room that's writing the song with them, putting the track together. So by the time you get the song done, hopefully they have a track that you can sing to, and there you have a full demo, and publishers like it because they don't have to pay anything for a demo. And the track guy likes it because he gets his name on a song. And that's why you see some of these newer songs with 5, 6, 7, 8 writers on it, because all these different things are going on, and one guy's a producer, and one guy's a track guy, and one guy's a writer, and one guy's a guitar player. And, you know, before you know it, there's 8 people on the song.
Wow. I added that one chord change in there. I get writing credit.
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
Wow. That should have been a B, and now it's a C. Thank you. God,
welcome. There you go. on the record now.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, Somewhere Other Than the Night. Stormy, mm-hmm. You said you had that played at your wedding?
I did.
Oh, wow. I'm liking her better all the time.
My ex-husband now, but then he used to play a lot of Garth Brooks, and he had to have his song picks in our list that were being played that day.
Wow, that's cool. I don't know if I've ever heard it used as a wedding song, but I like that idea.
I will say, and it's no joke, I think of all the song Garth's sung, to me, Somewhere Other Than the Night, when he sings it, is his greatest vocal performance. And we watched that one together when he was doing it at the CMAs that one year. But I mean, if he plays at the Grand Ole Opry, he plays it anywhere. There's something about him he feels that song when he performs it.
You know, he does. And the interesting thing is, you guys turned me on to that CMA thing that he did like 1992 or something when he debuted the song. And I have never heard him sound any better than he sounded then. It blew my mind when I went back and listened to it. I think the one thing about that song is when he cut it, he had the flu. So for some reason, he doesn't really like that version of it at all. It's never been on a greatest hits. It's never been on an anthology or anything. And I think it's because he didn't like his vocal on that. But boy, the vocal on the CMA thing was phenomenal.
You know, psychologically, I wonder if that's why on live he goes that extra mile, because he knows that the studio track wasn't what he wanted.
Probably so. And
when he's performing live, he's like, I'm going to make sure I deliver it, because I'm telling you, any clip I ever watch, man, I get goosebumps the way that man sings that song. And
yeah, and I do
like his rock alter ego. Chris Gaines. I like him a lot. Yes.
Yeah, you know, that album got panned really bad, but if you go back and listen to it now, it was so far ahead of its time. And even Don Henley cut one of the songs on there on his record, which says a lot when Don Henley cuts something that's somebody else's song. So it's good stuff. You know, just the crazy thing that happened on that was he had a whole movie in mind that he was shooting that was going to go along with the record, and they didn't get around to doing it because he was so busy. But the record was done and Capitol didn't have enough money coming in that year. So they begged Garth to put the record out without having the movie out. And a lot of people just didn't understand what was going on. You know, well, right. Who is this guy and why is he doing this? Well, it was supposed to go with this whole movie that was really cool. I kind of read the screenplay of it, but it never happened. And I think after all the bad press about it, Garth just decided he wasn't going to do it. Now, he may come back again and be Chris Gaines. You never know with that guy. But
that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
It would be wild. But let's get back to your new album, okay?
Yeah.
Because this has got so many great songs on it. It's basically Beatles to the Bluebird Cafe, right? Is track two. It's also the title track, right? The thing is, though, I want to go through some of the songs that hit me. Die Young is the first one I wanted to talk to you about.
Okay.
Knowing that the Beatles were a big influence on you, obviously, to many people. But especially you, right? Let's just start with that. What was the first moment you heard the Beatles in your life?
You know, I was like everybody else. I was in Kentucky, and most stuff got to us about 3 months after everybody else. But, you know, kids on the school bus or whatever were talking about the Beatles, and I knew nothing about them. So I was like every other kid and turned on the Ed Sullivan Show that night, and I was just shocked at what I saw in a good way. I'd never heard anything like that before. And, you know, the whole nation was kind of depressed because Kennedy had been assassinated. It was kind of like after 9/11, people were just walking around in a daze. And the Beatles brought a joy to the world on that show that the world needed at that time. And to me, on that show, February 9th, 1964, the repercussions of that are still echoing through the universe. You know, they changed music, they changed culture, they changed politics, they changed clothing, and they're still out there doing it, whether people realize that that has to do with the Beatles or not. And so that was part of the reason I did it, is just to remind people what an amazing event that was. And Die Young, to me, started out being a song to McCartney, and, you know, he's out there at 84 years old. He's getting ready to do a tour. He still sings in the same key that he sang everything in.
That's amazing.
He still plays 3 hours a night. And, you know, Ringo's out there still playing with his band. And so it was just a motivation for me of, yeah, I want to be doing that when I'm his age and more. You know, Tony Bennett was still singing when he was in his 90s. And these days, the music business makes you feel like if you're in your 40s, you're over with a lot of the times. I have young friends that have had number one records and they're trying to get a deal or something. And people are going, well, you're over the hill. You know, you're 45. Nobody wants to pay any attention to you. And so this was just I run into a lot of people that are facing that right now. And so this was maybe like a mantra almost for people to go, hey, I can reinvent myself. I can do something different. You know, Grandma Moses started painting when she was 60 something years old. That one woman jumped out of a plane when she was 104 a couple months ago. You know, it's not over till it's over. Yogi Berra said that, but that's true.
Right. It is true. It is true. And so what I wanted to do with you here is I wanted to play a clip of the song and the vibe I got from it.
Yeah.
When we played it. So I'm going to hit the mute button on everyone here. Stormy beat me to it. I knew she would. I'm going to share the screen here and we're going to play a little bit of this. This is Die Young. And I want you to listen closely and see if you get the same vibe I did here.
Seeing a hard day's night,
good, man. And let me pull you back in here. So the vibe I got, Kent, from that was very, in the very beginning when you rolled in, it was like, I want to hold your hand.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, he really got that. Whether he realized it or not, or whether you realize it or not, that was very, I want to hold your hand in the beginning.
Well, yeah, I was trying to get somewhere between I want to hold your hand, she loves you, that whole just electric vibe that they had that was so exciting, and change it up a little bit and put it in there.
You know, when I, where is that statue at? Is that in Nashville?
It's in Liverpool, England.
Oh, you were in Liverpool when you took
it? Yeah, I was in Liverpool and on the
Abbey Road?
No, this is Abbey Road's in London, but the Beatles were from Liverpool. And so on the dock where boats dock, because at one time it was a kind of grungy port town, you know, and kind of like sailors from all over the world coming in or whatever. But the Beatles statues are there. And I was wearing a Bluebird sweatshirt that day because it was cold over there. And I had just done a benefit at the Bluebird and they gave me the sweatshirt. And somebody took a picture, and when I saw that, I immediately knew I was going to do an album called From the Beatles to the Bluebird, because the Beatles got everybody started playing guitar, and the Bluebird, if it hadn't been for that and Garth playing If Tomorrow Never Comes and getting a record deal, I may be in prison or something about now. So,
idle hands, Kent.
Yeah. Wow. I just love the vibe of that song and what it does. And you know, honestly, I got a George Harrison vibe from that song too. Like I could see George Harrison playing that song.
I'd like to see that.
Let's bring him back.
They have an influence in their own way. I mean, the reason I started playing guitar was Roger McGuinn with Mr. Tambourine Man playing a Rickenbacker 12 string, which I see the Rickenbacker in the back there. But really what people don't know is George Harrison had the first Rickenbacker 12 string, and he used it in a Hard Day's Night movie. And that's where McGuinn saw it and said, what is that? I want to go get one of those. So it's all kind of tied in together on how that worked about that 12 string and the Beatles and Tambourine Man.
Let me tell you that Hard Day's Night is got to be the greatest intro and outro in music history to me. It's like in the top five, at least the way that song, one chord and it just resonates
right
like that. And then the outro is gorgeous. Right. Oh my God. I get goosebumps just from an intro and outro on one song.
Well, and you know, that's something that's missing today too, to me, is these little intros and outros on guitars on songs. Like the Beatles were so good at that. Day Tripper, Ticket to Ride, all these things. And, you know, John Fogerty was a master at it, of having these licks that you knew immediately what the song was. And so that's kind of what I was aiming for too, was to keep that in mind while we were doing this.
Ken, we've talked about that on here. I've talked about it on air. Just out of curiosity, in your opinion, when you talk about, you know, those intros, we've talked about the bridge and how now it seems like music just wants to get to the hook as fast as possible and then sit on the hook. Is that more of a characteristic of the songwriters just choosing not to integrate these type of aspects into the song? Or is that the industry? Is that the label saying, we don't want to just give us this and don't waste time on anything else?
Well, it has kind of gotten to that where they want you to get to the chorus as quickly as possible. And, you know, an intro guitar lick is going to maybe take up 10 seconds that they don't want to get taken up. And then, you know, with the track guys and stuff doing stuff, they're more keyboard oriented or whatever. And most of the songwriters here in Nashville are really not great guitar players. So it's kind of been wedged out from what people do these days as far as coming up with the licks, because it was the session guys who came up with the such great licks on the songs when you were demoing a song. And that really doesn't exist that much these days.
Nah, that sucks.
I mean, my first song that I had that was a top five record was a song called Headed for Heartache by Gary Morris. And Paul Worley, who became a huge producer, played guitar and produced that record. But that lick that he came up with on that song made that song, because the minute you heard that lick, you knew what that song was. And otherwise, it just would have been a mediocre song. But he turned it into something great because of that lick.
Yeah.
Didn't you have, by the way, Stormy, didn't you have five questions like James Lipton?
Yes.
When do you want to do those? Do you want to do like one come back, two come back, or do them at the end?
However you want me to.
Why don't you ask one? You ask five questions, Kent.
Oh, I've been dying to do this. You ready, Kent?
Do it. Do it.
No, I'm not ready, but I'll do it.
What's your favorite word?
I think it's magic.
Magic. Okay, I like that.
Because I've seen so much magic happen in Nashville and on Music Row, where you've got a guy cleaning churches and selling boots, and the next minute he's Garth Brooks, or you're having a friend over to write a song and he's got his head in the refrigerator and he sings a line and you tape it and ends up being the title of a song that becomes a number one song. So that's why I think what keeps you motivated is just finding that magic that's going to change the world when it comes out.
You know, that's like one, that. An observation is, it seems like Garth's character, because you've stayed friends with him and he's never forgotten you. Like, I was watching some performance you were doing shortly after Kim had passed away, and you guys were performing together and sharing stories. And Garth just seems like, no matter his celebrity or how big he got, he never lost his center.
I agree. He's the only one that I've dealt with really that's like that. You know, it's just amazing to me that after all this time, we're still friends. We still write together. We still hang out when we get a chance. And these days you can write a number one song with somebody and you never hear from them again. Right. And it's just a different world. Everybody's on to what's the next hot thing. What's the new big thing. Who's the producer I need to be using now. And he's never done that. So, he spoiled me right off the bat, but he's just that kind of person that he remembers who was there at the beginning, and he's not afraid to stick with them because of that.
Did you ever have a moment in your life where you had a moment of, why isn't my name in lights? Like, hey, I wrote this song and how come no one knows who I am? Did you ever have that moment in your life?
You know, I really hadn't. And I think part of it was I was a musician out on the road for a while, you know, trying to do the whole record deal thing and the whole bit. And I just finally got to the point, like, I'd rather just write songs and hopefully somebody else would record them. You know, I get to sleep in my own bed at night. And, you know, I love going out on the road and performing. I'm going to be doing a 10-day run in Texas here in the next couple of weeks. But it's not like 150 dates a year, or, you know, one artist I was working with one time knew where he was going to be every day for the next 3 years. And I'm like, I don't think I could handle looking at my calendar and knowing where I was going to be three years from now.
And never from the same town. Like, this person was going to be in like different cities every
year. Yeah. Every time's a different place. And it's like, you know, and actually when Garth was starting to get big, and I mean, he's still that way. If we go out somewhere, he has no bodyguards. He'll just walk in a place and we'll eat lunch or whatever. But there was one time where we were in this little hole in the wall and he had a beard and he didn't look like Garth Brooks, you know, and the little girl that was waiting on us, she says to me, God, he looks a lot like Garth Brooks. And I said, well, a lot of people say that, but somehow she figured that that's who he was. And this was before cell phones or whatever. And she must've got on the phone and called somebody. And before you knew it, there were 150 kids in this restaurant. And we were probably one of two people eating there, you know, and he signed autographs for 3 hours or something for him.
Wow.
You know, it was one of those Garth things. But when we left, he said, you know, Kim and I were with him and he said, you guys have it made, you know, you can go anywhere you want to go and do whatever you want to do, but you still got your name on things. And I said, buddy, I know it all too well. And I'm very grateful for what you do. And I'm very grateful for what I get to do.
Yeah. Oh, well said. Oh, that was a great story. Well, let's talk about Kim. We were talking about birds on a high line.
And, you know, in your storytelling, I remember, or even in the song, he said you guys were the three amigos. Yeah. I said the song gave me Tom Petty vibes. Dean, you had another observation.
I got Tom Petty within the first bit, but then as I continued to listen to it, I actually got Willie Nelson, Highwaymen. And then as I'm listening, it's like, wow, I could actually hear Kris Kristofferson singing this.
I like the way you think.
Yeah.
Didn't I put always Tom Petty vibes? I put that.
That was you. Was that you?
Yeah, it was that you. Okay. I was like, did you too? You got
no, no. Well, I think I was thinking like you. Okay. I'll give Stormy the credit for that. She wrote Tom
Petty there you vibes. Go. Well, you know, that song, New Way to Fly, was one of my favorite songs that Garth and Kim wrote. And I went to see him over in Ireland when he was over there this last year, and he did New Way to Fly, and he knew where I was sitting, and he walked over there and sang it. And so it just really embedded in my mind. And right after that, I went and did some shows down in Texas, and I had a day off. And in Texas, there's a whole lot of birds on the High Line, and it got me thinking about New Way to Fly and Birds on a High Line and Kim. And man, that song just came out. You know, I just sat down one day, and in 2 or 3 hours, I had the whole thing. Wow. And I always had wanted to write a tribute to Kim, and that was it. And the cool thing was, I sent it to his widow, and I was playing in Tulsa a couple weeks after that. And we were at Leon Russell's studio doing a gig. Wow. And his wife flew in from Knoxville, Tennessee to see me and thank me for writing that song. And that just blew my mind that she would come all that way to say thank you. But I love that song, and I love that man.
You know, the thing is, now was he in a fire?
He wasn't a fire. He was in a what they call a safe room for chemical engineers, and the room exploded, and the other guy died, and Kim came really close to death. He was in the hospital for over a year, and I think he had 100 operations or something like that, and he kind of realized God told him he needed to be a songwriter, and he moved to Nashville.
He didn't start writing songs till this injury. So right. When he was
laying in the hospital, he started writing songs, and just an amazing being. He never complained. He always showed up. He was always so much fun to write with, and you know, there's nobody like him either. What a blessing to be able to have him in my life.
So what was the first time you met Kim? Where was it? Like when did Garth meet Kim first?
He met Kim first, and Garth was always real good about putting different people together. And so he called me up one day and he said, hey, I got this kid that, of course, Kim was 10 years older than Garth. I have this kid that I've met, and we've been writing, and I think maybe we ought to get together with him. And what Garth used to do then, if he and I wrote a song, he would go play it for other songwriters to get their feedback, and he would play me other songs that he was thinking about recording and get my feedback. And so he had played Kim something that Garth and I had written a couple weeks before, and so Garth tells me, well, we can write with Kim. He hates that song that I played him, but he likes one line in it, and he thinks that could maybe be a title of a song. And so I'm thinking, okay, this guy hates my song. I'll write with him. And so what Garth didn't tell me is Kim was always on time, and Garth not so much. But so Kim showed up at my door the first time, and there wasn't Google or YouTube or anything like that. And you know, he'd been burned over 90% of his body. And so I opened the door, and I was kind of in shock of what I was looking at. And so I had him come in or whatever, and we started visiting. But Kim was such a big personality, then in like 5 or 10 minutes, you forgot all about that. But I always remember that day opening up the door, and there was Kim standing there. And so when Garth showed up, we started working on the song that Kim didn't like. And we ended up taking a break, and Garth was in another room singing something, and it was kind of bluegrassy, and I'm from Kentucky. And So I went in, I said, what is that? He said, I don't know, I'm making it up. And I said, well, let's all make it up together. So we worked on that song. Then we went back to the other song and we finished that. And so by the end of the day, we had two songs written. And I thought, well, this could be a pretty good writing situation. And we ended up with at least four number ones together and a lot of other cuts from a lot of people. And just the start of a friendship that was phenomenal.
What were those two songs?
One was What Never Happened Is What I'll Never Forget, which was the title that he stole from my other song that he hated. And the other one was Cold Shoulder that ended up on Garth's record. And the funny thing is both of those songs ended up being recorded by people, one by Garth and one by this other group called the Forster Sisters.
Wow.
How often do you hear somebody say, I hate your song? As a songwriter, do you hear that a lot, or is it usually just silence if somebody doesn't like it?
The best one I ever heard was when Tim Dubois was the head of Arista Records and somebody played him a song and he said, I really like that song. I never want to hear it again. So that's kind of the same way, I think. You know, I don't think you hear very many people say, I hate this song. But Kim would be very opinionated on about anything. So I could see where he would have said that. Most of the time, the only thing you hear is pass, pass, pass when you're playing people's songs. So hating the song, that's the only time I've heard it. And I'm glad that that's the only time I heard it. But it turned out good. So that's okay.
Wow. Well, that's in honor of Kim here. Let's play this song clip here. This, again, is available. Go get it. Let me go get this out here. This is Birds on a High Wire. And let me make sure I did the audio right here. No, I didn't. See? So check. There we go. Okay. So Birds on a High Wire. Here we go.
Every time I see birds on a high line, it makes me think about you and all of the amazing and crazy things I watched you do. You rose out of the flames, yeah, nothing could stand in your way. Boy from Poor Valley to a man on that CMA stage. And every time I see birds on a high line, I sing that first verse out loud. That fateful day we first met, man, we sure made a whole lot of memories I'll never forget. So I watch as those birds start to fly.
Just a beautiful tribute song. Let me pull this up here, get the back. So, and I'll go.
I love that song. And it's, and I talked about the Highwayman. I don't know if it's because, you know, over the last few days, I've been working on this thing for Strike TV. So I've been listening to a lot of Highwayman, and that's been stirring a lot of nostalgia, a lot of emotions in me, because I grew up listening to a lot of it. My dad was a big fan. So I listened to this, and it's like it's tickling that exact same nerve in me that I've been feeling here in the last few days. So, yeah, I love that.
Well, thanks. And, you know, I have to give credit to these guys that played on the record with me. We cut 10 songs in one day, and and I did all the vocals live while I was playing guitar. And those guys are just so amazing that I wanted it to be like the Beatles record, you know, where they cut 10 songs on the very first record in one day. And every time I listen to this record, I just pick out all these amazing parts these guys are doing. And that's Nashville, Tennessee for you, that you can go in and do something like that. And two of them play with John Party and his band. And another guy is this amazing guitar player, Steve Allen, who does all kind of stuff here in town. But, you know, without them playing on it, I'd just be up there singing and wouldn't be the same.
Well, you know, it's also the whole album. One of the things I took away as I was listening through it, it's just real. The lyrics are very real. The music is real. It's not like overly polished or overly glossed. It's just, as you said, it's folks that are playing some instruments. It's very real. I dig that.
Yeah, and most of these they did in one take.
Wow.
You know, the secret that I have is I usually, before I'm going to go in and do a record, I'll meet with the players sometime that week at my house, and we'll just run over the things to chart them. And I won't tell them what to play or anything. It's just, here's my idea. Let's chart them out where it'll be easier once we get to the studio rather than charting them out there. And it gives a little roadmap. So when we get there, everything just kind of falls into place. And I can play a little bit of the snippet of the work tape to get them back into where I'm looking to get the groove. And the rest of it, they just do it. It's just amazing. It's magic. You know, I'm back to that.
It's magic.
Again. And every time I go in and cut, I just say to the guys, okay, let's just make it fun and no pressure, no nothing else. Just let's make some music the old way. Everybody in a room having fun and creating together. And that's when the magic happens to me.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dean.
I was just saying, yeah, I use the word magic a lot myself with music.
Yeah. Well, it really is, you know, it's just what can happen in 3 minutes and how you can change a life, or you can have something that you wrote be in somebody's wedding or somebody's funeral or whatever. I mean, how cool is that? And,
Right, Stormy. What I was going to say, too, is when I first heard the intro to that song, it almost gave me Alabama vibes, too. Like, Feels So Right. You know that song, Feels So Right, which...
Yeah,
the people coming on after Exile wrote. That's what it reminded me of a little bit. I was like, wow, there's so much going on in this song emotionally, and it's so good. Stormy, question two.
Okay.
Mad.
Question two. What sound or noise do you like? I can probably almost predict this one.
I love playing electric guitar.
I knew it. I was going to say it's going to be guitar
more
or
fun to me than playing with my band and strapping on a guitar and rocking out on some songs.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky enough that I get to do that. And what I've been doing in the last couple of years since COVID is I'll do this singer songwriter thing like you would do at the Bluebird, where you tell the story. But then instead of me just doing it on an acoustic guitar, I've got a band behind me that can make it sound like the record. And that's a lot of fun to me, to present it how you really hear it in your head. And I think it gives people a deeper appreciation of what the whole concept is when you can do something like that.
Do you still have one of the guitars that you wrote one of the big songs on?
I do. I have two, actually. I may have a couple more of those, but the one... Well, Garth showed up the very first day to write. He didn't have a guitar. I guess he knew I had a studio and had guitars. And so I had a Martin D28 that was really one of my first good guitars. And we wrote If Tomorrow Never Comes on that. And then a couple years later, we were writing and he looked at his watch and said, oh, I'm supposed to go do a video. And so he ran out of my house and he got to the studio where they were shooting and he went, I don't have a guitar. So he called me to bring him a guitar. So I brought him that D28 and it ended up being in the dance video, which won video of the year.
Wow.
Beautiful song. That's another one.
Yeah. Beautiful. So when they started doing his thing at the Country Music Hall of Fame, they wanted some exhibit items and asked me if they could have that guitar. So that guitar has been at the Country Music Hall of Fame for I don't know, maybe 15 years now. And I go visit it every once in a while. And we always do a benefit for Alive Hospice here in Nashville. The Bluebird donates all the money in January for Alive Hospice. And so Garth comes and does that with me a bunch. And the one happened to fall on February 1st because we couldn't get it any sooner than that. And that was the day we wrote If Tomorrow Never Comes. So I went down to the Country Music Hall of Fame, got the guitar out of Hawk, and brought it to the Bluebird and used it that night, and then took it back the next day to the
hall.
Wow. It was pretty cool.
When you got an idea and you reach for a guitar for the first time, is there one that, you know, 80% of the time it's going to be this, or do you reach for the guitar based off of what you're hearing in your head?
Pretty much what I'm hearing in my head, you know, whether I want it to be an electric or acoustic or a bigger body or a smaller body, or whatever's in the room, you know, I kind of exchange them every once in a while. So they're all getting a little love and, you know, every song's got a guitar that it wants to be written on. And a lot of times they'll just start coming out because of the guitar that I chose.
I love what you just said there. A lot of songs have a guitar. Wait, say that again. That was awesome.
That was good.
Yeah, a lot of guitars have a song in them that they want to have come out. And it's funny because Harlan Howard, one of the greatest writers ever in Nashville, he would say, he would show up at the music store and go, "This guitar's got no more songs in it. I'm trading it in. Give me a new guitar." And that's what he would do. And it became the joke around town. "Well, this guitar's got no more songs in it. I got to go get a different guitar." And
that's awesome.
That's a song title right there.
Genius.
Yes, yep. It is.
Oh, my God. I love it. Stormy, why don't you ask another one? Because we're
all right. Okay.
You're good at this.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Oh. Oh, I think it's probably the sound of an ambulance or a police car.
Sirens. Behind you?
Yeah, I mean, here in Nashville, for some crazy reason, and maybe it's that way everywhere, if somebody calls 911, like two fire trucks show up, an ambulance shows up, two cop cars show up, and there's a whole lot of sirens going on at one time. And Sunday here, we've got a little park close to us, and it's got a lake, and I guess somebody tried to drown themselves there, and we were out on the patio with some friends eating dinner, and we just kept hearing siren after siren, and we could see them coming down the street. And then I found out today what it was, and it just, you know, every time I do that, I just send whoever it is blessings of whatever's going on, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's all you can do.
Yeah.
Pearl Jam. Go ahead.
Small town of Zebulon, North Kakalaki, right outside of Raleigh. And here, I think the police get bored. So for any event, you'll have 5-6 cars show up. Any event.
Right.
Wow.
Got to have something to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Pearl Jam recently, within the last 10 years, wrote a song called Sirens, which is, it's so emotionally incredible of a song because it deals with that, like hearing a siren and is it a person you love that it's coming for, kind of thing.
Right.
So that's, I think that's what, you know, that when you hear it, somebody's in trouble usually. And
yes, exactly.
You don't want it to be someone you care about, but you don't want it to be strangers either. And yeah,
that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. That's wow. All right. Stormy, ask another one. I like this before I get into another.
Yeah, shit, you got good questions.
Yeah. You got good questions.
Hey, guys, I'm telling
this
you.
This is awesome.
Other than your profession now, what would you like to attempt?
Oh, man. You know, I was kind of a painter before I became a guitar player. And my sister and I grew up in a little town, Woodstock, New York, before it was Woodstock, New York. And there were all kind of painters there from the Hudson Valley, painters, and I'd go to people's houses and they'd be working on some big painting that they did or whatever. And so I got into it at first, and then my sister got way better at it than me, and she became the professional artist. But I still love doing artwork, and you know, it may be something when I put down a guitar, maybe I'll pick up some paint and pencils and see what I can come up with.
The new Bob Ross over here.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
but happy guitars, right?
Happy guitars, clouds and guitars. You know,
yes.
I like what you said there. You're like the Woodstock before it was Woodstock.
Yeah. And it was always an artist community, but it inspired me as a little kid, you know, to go to these people's houses that were working on paintings, or somebody had written a book and they would autograph to me. And my dad worked for IBM, which at the time meant I've been moved. But, you know, it's just one of those things that I thought, well, that's a good way to make a living, you know, being able to write books or paint or something like that. It beats working on the assembly line. And right. So I kind of always had that in my mind. And I think because my parents had lived in Woodstock, they were very encouraging of my sister and I to do that, where, you know, I had a lot of different people in bands where we'd have to sneak the drummer's drums out of his bedroom, you know, to go play a gig or something because his parents didn't want him playing, or other people were going, you need to put that guitar down and get a real job, you know. And I never heard that, which was a good thing.
And what year was that? Because I think, what was it, Bob Dylan spent the summer in Woodstock. I think it was 64, 65 at some painter's
house. Yeah, I think it was 65 or 66. He had a motorcycle accident there.
Yes.
And he'd moved to Woodstock already because his manager, Albert Grossman, had a place there. And he was just trying to get away from the craziness of everything. And he wrecked his motorcycle. And actually, one of my cousins was the first police officer on the scene.
Get out of here.
Yeah, crazy. Wow. And when Dylan was recuperating, that's when he decided to pull back and do like John Wesley Harding and things like that, and just kind of changed his whole thing from what he'd been doing. But, you know, you watch that movie from 1965 when he's in London and in England, and he's the big folk guy, and you can tell he's just on amphetamines and getting ready to burn out. And I think the motorcycle accident was kind of like Kim Williams' accident. You know, it's like, I need to do something else from what I'm doing if I plan to be around. And God bless him, he's still around.
He is
writing songs, writing books, smoking cigarettes, and still Bob Dylan.
Yes, do you imagine when he showed up and they look at his license and they go, Robert Zimmerman?
Yeah, who's that guy?
Robert Zimmerman. Right. You look like Bob Dylan.
Well, you know, he did one show as Elston Gunn, spelled with three N's, G-U-N-N.
Really?
He's the piano player for Bobby V.
I love it.
Oh, yeah. Good. See, he's a book. He's an encyclopedia.
He knows stuff.
Dean's encyclopedia man. I'm like geeky fan. Stormy's like, I got questions.
That's what makes it good.
Fine, right? We did four.
I just think that's crazy that you're talking about Woodstock and art. I was like, oh, wait a minute, Bob Dylan spent time there. And then it was your cousin that showed up. It's like, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And things come to full circle, you know?
Well, and I moved back up there in like 73 or something. I was working with some guys that were in Pure Prairie Leg, and they were living up there. And it was interesting. I was reading a book on the band, and I met some of those guys when I was there. But one of the people that he mentions in the book was another guy that was a friend of mine that I hadn't heard that name in years, and his dad owned a drugstore. And it's like, wow, it keeps pulling me back there, you know. And I took my wife there, I think in 2018, she wanted to see where I came from, and she fell in love with that little town too, because it's still the same as it was, you know. It's still, maybe if there's 2,000 people, that would be maybe an exaggeration. The only thing that's changed is since COVID, everybody figured they had moved out of New York City, and they all moved up there, and the housing prices doubled. So that's happened a lot of different places. It's like, I can live anywhere, so why do I want to live where I'm living? And so that was a big change to see that.
Wow.
Kenny Chesney wrote a song that he actually didn't record. I think Rascal Flatts did it. That Take Me There song. And
that's a great song.
Oh my God. Take Me There. When you said that, like, your wife wanted to go see where you're from. That's right. Exactly. That song sums that up. When somebody wants to see the person they love, where they came
from. Take Me There. Yeah.
Take Me There is that. That's one of those songs I wish I had wrote it, because it's so beautiful of a song. And
well, I do too now. Dang.
Well, there's a good question. There's a good question for you. What's the song that when you heard, you went, damn, I wish I had written that.
Oh, there's a bunch of them. You know, I think the 90s had those. I call them pull over to the side of the road songs, you know.
Yeah, because you want to just hear that, right?
Yeah. Someone's heaven, Stormy.
Well, you either want to cry or you just want to pull over and take it all in. But there's about five or six of them. One is Everything That Glitters Is Not Gold by Dan Seals. The song Remembers When, what a great song. Don Henley's Heart of the Matter.
Oh, that song's incredible.
Yes.
Dan Fogelberg's Auld Lang Syne.
Yeah.
You know, these are songs that I miss people writing things like that, but I don't really hear them that much these days. So I'd like to see it get back to more something like that, heartfelt things that make you pull over to the side of the road.
We're lining up an interview with Joe Vitale, and so we're going to be talking about some Dan Fogelberg as he played on the albums. I love Fogelberg. Love him.
Oh, yeah. He's one of my favorite all-time songwriters.
You know, and people don't really even know about him, you know, how great he was unless you're in a certain age group. But what a talented individual, and a big influence on me, and actually a big influence on Garth. You know, we've talked about him a lot, and I think they had a Dan Fogelberg tribute album, and Garth sang There's a Place in the World for a Gambler, which I thought was pretty cool. But Fogelberg, what an amazing being. And his one line really sticks with me when I'm traveling now, because he wrote it 40 years ago: the audience is heavenly, but the traveling is hell.
Yep. Oh, yes.
It's a good thing he's not alive now.
On Auld Lang Syne, right? That song is amazing. One more. You had one more, right, Stormy? Five?
Yeah.
4 minutes left.
Okay. Oh, what's your favorite curse word? No, I have to do this one.
Cancel.
Which one?
I don't know.
I have a big vocabulary, my wife says. So whatever they are, they make my little doodle go run and hide somewhere. So take your pick. I probably use it.
And before you go, with a few minutes left, I want to talk. There's one song you do called The Gift She Is.
Right.
I love the intro to the song. Dean, you had a note about this that I thought was interesting.
Yeah. So I have this woman that comes in and puppy sits for us when we're out of town, and I always leave a guitar out in case maybe she has somebody come over or whatever, you know, and I don't think she plays guitar, but I got home one time and I picked up the guitar and I strummed it and I thought, my God, how'd this get so out of tune? And so then I started thinking about it and I thought, this is tuned to Dadgad, which not a lot of people know about Dadgad.
English beat.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you know, a lot of people use drop D or whatever, but not a lot of people use Dadgad. And so I started playing around with what it was once I realized, and that's when I came up with that lick or whatever, and just decided I was going to put some music and words to that lick that I came up with.
Yeah, that stumped me because it was like, wow, it sounds like an open tuning, but at the same time, it also sounded like the strings were kind of loose. I started thinking, it makes me think of, I've got a cigar box dulcimer. I was like,
right.
Makes me think of that.
Well, you know, dulcimers the same way. They're just tuned with three notes. And so that's kind of what you got with Dadgad. And it's really hard to get a guitar and tune in that. So, you know, there's places where the low D's a little out of tune because I'm hitting it so hard, but that's what I do. But hey, it's real, you know, and that's what I like about it.
Funny thing about Dadgad is I mentioned English beat. So I had Dave Wakeling on. They were a ska punk band, and he wrote that song. And one time he got a phone call. He was telling me that his wife at the time answered, and she goes, "Look, Pete Townsend's on the phone." Dave Wakeling goes, "Sure, he's going to call me on a Sunday at 2 p.m. He gets on the phone, and it was Pete Townsend. He goes, "Hey, Dave, it's Pete. I'm here with David Gilmour. We're trying to find out the tuning to your song, Save It For Later." He goes, "You got to be kidding me. You mean the guy that wrote the Axe Eugene? What was that song about Axe Eugene by Pink Floyd, Dean?
I think so.
Carry That Axe Eugene or something?
Yeah.
He's asking me how I tune my guitar. And it was Dadgad. That was the thing.
You got Gilmour there too, and they can't figure it out. That's
Townsend and Gilmour.
I love it.
They were stoned.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you, Kent, for taking time out and spending time with us here. I appreciate it so much.
I love the new arrangement here, and I like having Stormy here. And always Dean. I love him because he knows the answer to everything. And,
oh, no.
And you keep it going. So thank you guys so much.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kent.
Uh-huh. Have a good evening. Great night.
I already have. I saw you guys.
Oh, aww. Thank you, man. You made our night too.
Oh, so good. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. Have a good night, Kent.
You too.
Good night, Kent.
You.